Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there, friend. Vish Khanna talking to you right off the top of the show. A bit unusual. I have an announcement. Like many of my colleagues who are living in Ontario, Canada, under Doug Ford's provincial government, my day job at a campus and community radio station may not exist for much longer. For a sampling of what I'm talking about, please go to your favorite campus and community radio station's website. I'm sure there'll be a little announcement and maybe even a way that you can help them financially or otherwise in this current state of affairs. But because you're listening to this podcast, I wanted to tell you something. I would like nothing more than to keep making episodes of Creative Control every week, but that requires a significant bump in the revenue that this show generates so that I can feed my family and also house them too. I have decided that both food and shelter are important for my family. Call me old-fashioned. This is just how I feel. So I'm looking into subsidies and grants. I'm not having much luck, but I'm looking into those. If you or someone you know wants to help keep the show going, please consider making a monthly flexible donation to my Patreon page, patreon.com/creativecontrol. If you go there, you'll see our current levels do not sustain a guy trying to provide for his wife and his two kids and make a podcast. So maybe a stable day job beckons. But if a stable day job beckons, can I keep doing the show? I don't know. I have no idea. I hope that we can just boost our Patreon pledges and maybe get it to a point where it's sustainable. So thanks if you already donate to the show. If you don't and you can't, that's fine too. But please spread the word as Creative Control's future depends on increased financial support. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you. Sean Ono Lennon is a musician, songwriter, and producer based in New York City. The only child of Yoko Ono and the late John Lennon, Sean has been prolific over his own musical trajectory, making solo albums and collaborating with others. In 2019, he's celebrating ATO Records' release of South of Reality, the second album he's made with Les Claypool of Primus, under the name The Claypool Lennon Delirium. The record has earned rave reviews and has prompted the band to tour extensively. And Sean and I had a chance to talk recently for both an Exclaim magazine assignment that I was tasked with completing and also for this show. And so we touched upon some personality questions, his relationship with his parents and how they inspired his interest in visual art, why he'd like to work with Bob Dylan. The Toronto show, I saw him play with Chibo Matto as the band opened for Beck on the Odelay tour. His fond memories of hanging out with Michael Jackson at Neverland Ranch and much more. With the support of listeners like you who subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly pledges at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from CFRU 93.3 FM, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, this is the 468th episode of Creative Control, featuring the gifted and talented Sean Ono Lennon, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Sean. How's it going?
Hey, how you doing?
It's nice to speak with you again. You and I spoke many years ago, as I recall.
I'm glad you recall that because it was a blur for me.
It was a blurry conversation, as I recall. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in upstate New York, surrounded by snow. I'm at my studio.
Oh, nice, nice. Yeah, we've got, it's just like a blizzard here. I'm calling you from Guelph, Ontario.
Yeah, you probably have it pretty bad. We had about 3 days of snow up here.
Oh,
but
yeah.
It wasn't too bad.
Nice. Well, it's winter. I'm not complaining. I prefer that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. You know what I mean?
Yes, obviously I do. But it's a little scary. I've heard that there was the worst winter ever in Iran and Germany or something, which is odd, or Switzerland.
Oh.
Or I guess where Germany and Switzerland meet.
Oh.
And so I think it is extreme weather. It's just not necessarily always in the warming direction.
Yes, exactly.
Go either way.
Yes,
it's weather extremes.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, I appreciate the time. Again, we're going to do the Exclaim Magazine questionnaire, and then after that, we can talk about the Claypool Lennon Delirium. I've been enjoying the new record quite a bit, and I want to ask you some questions about it. But are you ready to answer the Exclaim questionnaire?
I think I am. What is it, a rating system, like 1 out of 5, or are we doing a yes or no?
No, it's actually, I'm going to ask you questions, and you have to answer them, elaborate as much as you can. There's no yes or, well, maybe there's a yes or no. No, there isn't. No.
So it's a kind of Jungian, it's like a Jungian thing.
Yeah, it's like here's a question, why or what, and then you have to, and then I say, and you know, can you expand upon it, that kind of thing.
Oh my gosh, but I don't want to reveal the depths of my subconscious to the world.
Well, you shouldn't have answered the phone, my friend. I think
all right, I'm ready. I'm
that
ready.
Was your
I'm
first mistake.
I'm on my couch.
Okay, this is the preamble to the questionnaire. Before we begin, please state your name, your hometown, your current headquarters, and any of your upcoming activities, especially Canadian tour dates and new releases.
Okay. My name is Sean Tarua Ono Lennon. Taro is my Japanese name. Ono is my mother's maiden name. I'm stationed in New York City for the most part, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And that is my hometown. And I'm a musician and songwriter. Been producing also, but I guess that goes under the umbrella of a musician.
Yeah.
And I do have some dates in Canada, but I don't know the exact dates right now, but I know that we're heading across the border. And it's coming up this year. I just don't know the actual date. Like, if I wasn't using my phone for this interview, I might I might do a little Google searching, but I don't know exactly. I'm not good at remembering tour dates. I get on the bus and it's a blank after that.
Do you want to send people to a website right now where they could learn the dates?
Sure. My record company website always has all the tour dates that I am involved in. It's chimeramusic.com, chimera music.com. You can get all my tour dates and Delirium tour dates and everything that I'm a part of.
Okay, all right, there you go. And new releases is I mentioned the,
you can probably get that also, sorry, on the ATO record label website, but I don't know the address offhand. I'm sure it has to do with ATO Records.
Okay.
Or something like that.
All right. That's good. All right. Let's move on to the very first question of the Exclaim questionnaire. Number one.
Oh, so that didn't count.
It's kind of a preamble, like I said. It's like an introduction. It's like if I want to let you cross over the border, you have to answer all those questions.
Name, I
see. Hometown, current HQ.
I've definitely answered questions going across the border into Canada, let me tell you.
Yeah, well, I've answered them going across to America, too. And
ain't nothing you can throw at me that they ain't thrown at me over.
All right, let's see. I accept your challenge, and I'm going to go forth here. Number one, what are you up to, current projects?
Actually, I just finished yesterday working on some music with Bournes. This guy, Garrett Bournes, is a musician who I like a lot. We did about 2 weeks of a session at my studio in upstate New York with his friend Tommy English, who's a producer, songwriter guy who he works with, and it was really fun.
Okay.
So I was working on that. And then before that, I was working on a solo project, but I kind of put that down for a little while, but I'm picking it up again, hopefully.
Okay, cool. Appreciate that answer. Question number two. What are your current fixations in the realms of music, films, books, art, TV, food, lifestyle, trends? What are your current fixations, Sean?
Oh, boy. Well, I've got so many interests regarding film and music and art and stuff. It depends on how deep we want to go. But, I mean, just superficially, what I've been watching is the Mike Judge series on the tour bus.
Oh, man. That is so...
The tour bus choice.
It's so good.
It's probably the greatest of TV I've ever seen. I just love it. But that's not... I mean, in terms of what I like that I'm obsessed with, I mean, you know, I like great filmmakers like Fellini and Bergman and Kubrick and stuff. I mean, that's probably the film that I'm obsessed with, like Jodorowsky and stuff from the 60s and 70s.
I don't mean to highlight this, but the question was current fixation. So you could say...
Oh, I thought you said... But I thought you meant what are my fixations right now, but you didn't say current...
That's
art.
True.
Artists. Well, you said what are my fixations right now. So generally, I tend to be obsessed with Fellini and Nino Rota, let's say. Nino Rota, like Italian film scores, I'm quite obsessed with. But I mean, if you mean in a kind of fleeting way, like what is my what is my current trend? I've been watching the Mike Judge shows for sure. That's the funniest thing I've ever seen. And you know what else? This is kind of lowbrow. I've been watching this show called Norseman. It's like this Viking comedy show from Norway. It's hilarious. That's one of the funniest things. I guess I've been watching a bit of comedy because the world is so scary when you read the news every day that you just want to go home and watch something that makes you laugh.
Yeah.
Those are the two shows that I watch. And in terms of music, well, let's see. In terms of contemporary bands, are you thinking? I really like, you know, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard.
Uh-huh.
I really like those boys. Let's see, what else do I like that's new? There's this band called Drug Dealer that I like.
Oh, I don't know them.
Yeah. Let me see. What do I listen? I mean, you know, the funny thing is I mainly listen to older music. I've been really listening a lot to Milton Nascimento, this Brazilian artist from the 70s. I was looking through my dad's record collection. I found a bunch of old Brazilian records, so I got really into Milton Nascimento last year. I've been listening to that a lot.
Oh, okay.
Let me think.
That's good. That's enough. You don't have to.
Okay.
It was an either or. It was or. It could have been any of those. I feel badly that I phrased the question so poorly that you feel pressure to go through every single thing. But that was good. That's a lot.
I was just scratching the surface, man. No, I didn't know when you said currently if you meant current artists or what I'm currently into, because that could be, you know, Russ Myers, for all you know.
I've been doing this questionnaire and asking this questionnaire for years, and this has never caused that much confusion. But I appreciate exactly what you're saying. It is a bit of a confusing question, but I do think...
I'm easily confused.
No, I don't think that's true, but I do think we should move on. Are you okay to move on?
I'm ready.
Okay, number three.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Number three, why do you live where you do?
Well... You know, I was born and raised in New York, so I'm a New Yorker more than anything else, even though my parents, you know, were immigrants. But I think the main reason is because my mom lives here and she likes New York. And I wouldn't feel right if I left the city that she lived in because, you know, she doesn't have a lot of family to take care of her. So I sort of stick around mainly for that reason. And also my girlfriend likes New York. We always talk about if we could live anywhere else. And I think I'm more open to the idea than she is. So
I see. Okay.
The women in my life are keeping me here.
That's a good answer. How is your mom doing these days?
She's good. I mean, you know, she's 85, so she's doing great considering her age. And she's always had a lot of energy and she's always busier than I am, you know. Just even the last time I went to see her, she was planning another art project with somebody, and she's incredibly prolific. She just is always doing something. So I feel very blessed to have such an active mom at her age.
Yeah, no, it is amazing. All right. Well, speaking of art, question four: name something you consider a mind-altering work of art, and this can be in any media, but not your own.
I love that you use the plural of media properly.
It's very Canadian. Yeah. I'm Canadian. I know how to talk.
Yeah, I talk a bit too.
I don't know. I don't even know what I just said. I don't know what that means. Actually, I'm sorry.
I guess the most mind altering movie for me would probably be Holy Mountain by Jodorowsky or Jodorowsky.
Yeah,
it's a film that my dad produced with Alan Klein, who was the Stones and later the John Lennon manager, or part of the Beatles manager, I guess you'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the trippiest movies ever. If you watch that, it's hard to watch it all the way through. It's so aggressively surreal. It's really interesting. Apparently, George Harrison was up for the lead role of the kind of, I guess, Jesus character, but ultimately that didn't work out for some reasons. But, yeah, it's a very visual film, and it's in fact, I don't think there's any dialogue in it. It's very interesting, and I recommend it. It's beautiful, but also terrifying.
All right, I appreciate that answer. All right, we move on. Number five, what has been your most memorable or inspirational gig, either one you played or attended, and why?
Man, this is going to be hard. Let me think. The most memorable one I may have been a part of or not. It's hard to say because I've been to a bunch of gigs that I really loved. You know, I got to see the second run, I think it was, of the Pink Floyd The Wall tour.
Oh, yeah.
When I was young. And I think that was my favorite show of all time. No, but the other show that I saw that blew my mind as well was Prince, though.
Oh.
On Purple Rain, on that tour. And that might have been, I don't know, it's hard to say which one was, but I think honestly I like The Wall better. I'm more of a Pink Floyd fan. That was probably the greatest show I've ever seen, because they did the Frankenstein in the bed and the floating pig, and I mean, it was just so mind-blowing. And at the time, I didn't know much about Pink Floyd, but I didn't know that it was the second time they'd done the tour or something, or that it was the revival. But to me, it just seemed like the greatest show on earth. I remember all the lasers and the lights and the music, and I think that impacted me the most, probably. I think it was at Giant Stadium, but it's hard to remember because I was so young.
Right.
But that show really kind of stuck with me. It was the production on that tour was just so over the top. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it since then.
No, it revolutionized concert performances, didn't it? Like that tour just changed everything. Everyone had to go big after that.
Yeah, I mean, I it's hard for me to view it in context again because I was so long, but I mean, as far as I understand it, it wasn't just The Wall of Pink Floyd that revolutionized, you know, concert going and technology. It was their whole careers. Like when they did Live at Pompeii, that was raising the bar too. I don't think there's anything that was that well recorded in a field recording that was also a film. I mean that was sort of raising the bar in terms of technically. Just the setup is incredible. The PA and the speakers and the recording, and that it's live and it's being filmed, and there's like aerial shots. It's pretty mind blowing.
Yeah.
And then I think they also innovated a lot of live sound technology before The Wall even. So I think people were kind of chasing them for a long time.
Yeah.
I know the Dead were always kind of having a lot of cutting edge technology too, but I think Pink Floyd was probably, I don't know, they were pioneers in a lot of live, like surround sound stuff. That's what I've heard, even before The Wall, for sure. And obviously they started as a light show accompaniment, right? I mean,
yeah.
Early days before they had vocals and stuff when they were with Sid. So I think their shows were always a spectacle, at least.
Well, that's amazing. You got to see that. That's really
incredible. That was probably the most amazing show I've ever seen, if I can really think about it. And there was another show. Sorry, I know I'm supposed to answer only one. One time I got to see Levon Helms at the live at the Midnight Ramble too. Charlotte and I went in upstate New York.
Oh, wow. And
I didn't realize how magical it was, but he basically passed away, I think, a year and a half or two after that. And looking back, that was one of the most magical moments too, because we were standing right behind his drum set. It's a very small place, that studio. And I guess that would be the other one that really stuck with me. We were all in tears. It was so beautiful, the music and everything.
I got to see Levon Helm play two or three times. And Sean, you know, my son is 7 years old. You know, his name is Levon.
Oh, wow.
So he means...
Well, Levon was so sweet, man. He was such good energy. And I don't know, the musicianship of everybody that played with him was so high. The caliber was so high. It kind of blew our minds. I remember that we felt like we were witnessing something monumental.
I think his character as well. I mean, I'm a music fan. I'm a drummer. So I got a lot of grief for naming my kid after a drummer, you know. But it's really the way he carried himself. Did you ever read his autobiography by chance?
No, I would love to. I should check that out, because he was so kind and sweet, and he just seemed like such a deep soul when we got to hang out.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had had a chance to speak with him in some capacity. That's a regret of mine. But anyway, those are both great stories. We should move on. In the interest of the questionnaire,
I'm ready.
We should move on. Number six. What have been your career highs and lows?
Oh, Lord. yeah, I don't know what my career high is. I honestly don't think I've had one yet, but I've had a lot of lows. A lot of lows. I think the worst thing that, oh God, it's hard to say. There's so many embarrassing moments. One of the worst ones was Charlotte and my band, The Ghost. We got hired to play a movie opening party at a film festival in Cannes. And at the time we were acoustic. And for some reason, like, we didn't realize that they were just booking us as some kind of circus freak show, like a sideshow to just kind of gawk at us or something. But we thought they really wanted to hear us play. But I wound up playing acoustic guitar, and it was the two of us singing in this nightclub in Cannes, which was super, you know, a kind of super Euro trashy disco techno vibe. And they were just blasting techno music the whole time.
Oh,
it was so bizarre, because we just stood there and we just tried to sing and play, but no one could hear us and everyone just ignored us. And the people that did look at us were just kind of gawking at us like we were some kind of zoo animal or something, like a petting zoo or something. It was so weird, because it was, you know, I mean, I should have known, but it only occurred to me on stage that they obviously were just thinking that it would be interesting to have me for whatever reason, because of my dad, and with her because she was a model or something. And it was just so embarrassing. But yeah, we were forced to play for like a good hour without being heard, just standing there playing while there was a DJ playing techno music incredibly loud. Yeah, it was pretty humiliating. But I've had a lot of low moments. I mean, gee whiz. Oh man, I've played some weird places. Like when I was in a band, Shiba Mata, we toured with the Butthole Surfers, and I love those guys. Yeah. But that was one of the weirdest. We played some of the weirdest places I've ever seen in my life, like truck stops where there were weird people at the dressing room, like with guns and stuff in Texas, kind of threatening us. They're like, y'all the Butthole Surfers, what are y'all, a bunch of, you know, bad words. I'm like, no, we're not the Butthole Surfers, it's not us. They're like, well, I got my gun, because y'all better not like mess with the dressing room now, like my boss told me you're some miscreants. And you know, people threatening us with firearms and stuff like that. I've been in a lot of low point situations. I'm still waiting for that high moment. I believe it'll happen one day when I get to produce Bob Dylan someday. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, I'm waiting.
Can you put a call out to another artist I love very much, Bob Dylan? Seen him like 60 times in the last 20 years. I love Bob Dylan. Could you not put a call in and say, hey, I want to work with you? He doesn't work with anyone really.
No, I wouldn't do that for a million reasons, because I mean, it wouldn't make sense. Yeah. I wouldn't ask anyone to work with me who didn't already want to work with me. You know,
yeah, that's true.
It's like, it has to be natural. I'm not going to Just be like, hey, you may know like my dad's band.
Bob Dylan wrote a song sort of about your dad on one of his last albums.
Yeah, Roll On John.
Yeah. Right. What'd you make of that?
I thought it was very sweet. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that. I thought it was sweet as well, as a fan of both your father and Bob Dylan's, for sure. Yeah. Okay, we will move on. We shall move on. I think you're right. The high is still to come, perhaps. Maybe that's an
still waiting for the high to kick in.
Yeah.
The delayed reaction.
Okay, here's another one. Number 7. What's the meanest thing ever said to you before, during, or after a gig?
A lot of those. Well, you know, my first show, I think it was my first show for this record I made when I was young, Into the Sun, this solo record I did. And, oh man, I think that was like really my moment of leaving childhood and entering the real world and realizing it was a cold shower of reality. Basically, I had no idea what people thought of me. Generally, I didn't think about it. You know, I'd just been playing in this band, Chiba Mata. I was a bass player, and I didn't think about what it would be like for me to try to make music on my own and how people might have a resistance to that or resent me for it or not even want me to do it, let's say.
Huh.
I remember my very first show, like the front row was just all these kind of, let's just say they were much older than my main fan base.
Right.
And they were, you know, they looked, well, let's put it this way. I don't think they knew whether I was Sean or Julian or, you know, even Stella McCartney. They just knew I was a child of a Beatle.
Right.
And the whole show, they were heckling me like, why aren't you playing Yesterday? They're like, play Yesterday, like between every song.
Wow.
But the funny thing is, I may be hyperbolizing in my mind, but I really think they only called out Paul songs as well, which I thought was an extra little.
Oh, purposeful?
No, I don't think they were purposely even knowing what they were doing, but it just added a depth to the humiliation.
Right.
It was a little, it was odd. And, you know, that was the first time I realized it was going to be a long haul, my music career. I was like, oh, that makes sense. I see. This isn't going to be like the other stuff I'd been doing. Because, you know, I'd been playing in a band with this where I wasn't the leader. No one even knew I was in the band. So I got to tour and just experience it from a normal perspective. And it wasn't until I tried my own thing that I realized that it was never going to be like that for me.
I got to see you play with Chiba Mata opening for Beck in Toronto.
Man, I think I remember that show. Which venue was it?
It was called the Concert Hall.
Yeah, man. Of course I remember.
Masonic
that.
Temple or something like that. And
yeah, that was beautiful.
You guys
that
were
was one
you
the
were
best
great.
Tours I've ever been on.
Yeah, well, you were great. I love Chiba Mata already, but like it was, I didn't know you were. This is going back what 20? When was that? That must have been 97, 98 or something like that.
It was sometime between 1895 and 2050.
Well, anyway, it was great, and you looked like you were having a lot of fun.
I was.
Yeah.
That was before the world broke me. That was when I was still filled with positive energy and dreams and optimism.
Man,
no, it was really fun. Opening for Beck was an honor, and that tour was when Odelay broke.
Yes.
So we that's the only tour I've ever been on, actually, where we're playing these normal sized little theaters, and then halfway through the tour we get a call from the tour manager, Beck's tour manager, and they're like, We've rebooked the whole tour. It's all basically arenas and amphitheaters. I've never seen a tour get changed midway through tour. It was just like, we can't do this. We're having to, you know, quadruple the audience size. So it was amazing. That was super exciting to see that, to witness a record blowing up like that.
Yeah, like I'd seen Beck a few times by then, and I was lucky to see. We were lucky, I think, to see it in the theater. Like the concert hall is a very small venue compared to what you ended up doing.
Yeah, and that was in the middle of the tour, so it was interesting. It was really interesting.
So this must have been 96. I'm guessing. This
that sounds about right.
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it was very cool. Okay, we move on. Question number eight. What should everyone shut up about?
Oh man, so many things, don't you think? I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, Yeah, I mean,
I just did one of these with Jeff Tweedy. You know Jeff Tweedy? Yeah, you must be friendly with Jeff on
some level. Yeah, I've performed with Jeff before. Yeah. I love Jeff. And I was roommates with Nels Klein.
Yes.
Who is his guitar player.
Nels has become a dear friend of mine, too. And anyway, Jeff, when he answered this question recently, what should everyone shut up about, said everything. And I that's happened before, but
that's kind of how I was just thinking about it. I mean, we live in an age where we all of us are able to air like the slightest thought on a whim that we have through all these social media platforms. And it just feels so unnecessary. But I feel like it's not just unnecessary. I think it might even be dangerous for the fabric of our cohesiveness of our social fabric is being threatened, because instead of interacting with communities in the physical world, we just kind of glibly, you know, vent our most flippant frustrations and even joys and whatever it is, but it's all relatively unidirectional. It's all relatively one-sided. I mean, you can have a conversation on Twitter, but for the most part, you're just kind of saying something and it's going out there. So it's not really, you're not getting a reaction from a physical person who's in the same city or building or room as you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It feels kind of like it doesn't feel connected. And I, you know, obviously that's a paradox, because the internet is literally the thing that's connected us the most. But, you know, it really feels as if the more we try to connect over the internet, the less connected we are as a civilization. And, you know, that sounds like an old fuddy-duddy getting mad about technology, but I'm not a, you know, technophobe. I'm not a Luddite. I like technology, but it feels like it's compromising our ability to have real conversations and to treat each other like human beings. Because it's very easy to sort of think of somebody who's tweeting or whatever as not a completely human person, because they're only represented two-dimensionally.
Completely dehumanizing, and as much as it's brought us together, it's contributing to the erosion of decorum and civility.
Exactly. So what you have is all these slivers of people interacting as opposed to the whole person.
Yes.
And it feels like there are just these shadows that represent people getting entangled in these webs of confusion. And so I honestly think it's connected to why we're so politically divided and why we have Trump in the White House. I think it's all connected to this kind of frenetic kind of interaction.
Yeah, he's the avatar of dishonesty and treating people poorly, and that's what's going on.
But not just that he represents that behavior, but I think he's a result of it, in that people started to polarize because of social media. Because it's very easy to get into cliques and tribes and be like, well, we're the people that think this, and everyone who tweets otherwise is an enemy.
Yeah,
it becomes really tribal and superficial, and I think it's dangerous. And I'm hoping that we all kind of eventually unplug from the worst aspects of social media. I'm hoping that's where it's going. And I do know a lot of young people are doing that.
Yeah, I think so too. It's just to get rid of or to at least help with your anxiety. It's very anxiety inducing.
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of psychology studies that show that especially young girls are, you know, more prone to destructive behavior like cutting or suicidal ideation and stuff. And that's directly connected to Instagram or whatever. It's terrifying.
Well, this seems like a nice segue into question number 9. What traits do you most like and most dislike about yourself? I said that with way too cheery a lilt. I apologize. I didn't mean to go right from the heavy dark thing to the, that's just the order of the questions.
Oh no, it's fine. I was born and raised in Manhattan, and it's a very self-critical culture, the New York culture. So I'm really good at self-loathing. I have a lot of skill and talent in that department.
By the way, this is both like and dislike. So you have to go both ways, if you can.
Oh, I see. I thought there was a comma, like, what do you like, comma, and what do you dislike? But you mean, what do you like and dislike at the same time?
Yes.
A trait that you both love and hate about yourself.
Well, it doesn't have to be the same trait, by the way.
Oh, I thought that's what you were saying.
No,
that would be very complicated, because I do often feel that the things you like about people are the flip side of a coin of a dichotomy that, you know, that you don't like about them. The thing you love about them tends to turn into the thing you like least about them on some level, especially after a period of time.
Isn't it that the thing you don't like about someone else is really a thing you don't like about yourself?
Well, that's also true. I think that's a different statement, but okay. Sure. I think if you don't dislike an aspect of yourself, you won't be triggered by it in other people.
I see. Okay.
I do believe that.
Okay.
But I also think that, let's say you're in a long-term friendship or relationship with somebody, the thing you tend to love most about them at first is a sort of a flip side of a coin of the thing that starts, you know, stressing you out the most.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that tends to be true as well. But in my case, gosh, I mean, you know, I was going to say, I really don't like my singing voice. It's funny, but I mean, that, I know that's not the kind of thing you were talking about, but it's like, it's always bothered me. I always wished I could be a better singer, because I do think I have some talent with music. And I think if I could sing well, that if I could sing really, really well, I think I'd enjoy my music better. Hmm. No, I don't like my voice. I hate the sound of my talking voice even. Like, that's why, you know, if I listen to a radio or podcast, it just stresses me out so much. I don't like the kind of nasal whine of my voice. It really bothers me.
Okay.
But I do like, I think I'm a good bass player. You know, when all is said and done, you know, I'm okay on guitar and piano, and I'm a pretty good songwriter. But I think what I'm really good at is bass playing. So that would probably be the thing I like about myself the most, is I can pretty much hold it down on a bass. If you throw a bass into my hands, I can slap it for you.
All right. That's a good answer. All right. We move on to question 10. What's your idea of a perfect Sunday?
A perfect Sunday. Well, honestly, the thing I enjoy most in life is when I write a song and I record it and I don't hate it, when I love it, you know. there's like a window sometimes of a few days when I just think, wow, this is really great, and I listen to it over and over. And that's probably the greatest high in the world. Like, that's what I do music for, is that feeling of, wow, we've made something good and it sounds great. And it's this sort of pleasure of listening to something that you like and that doesn't bother you. And, you know, often I'll record something and just think it's awful. So my favorite, you know, day would be, and they are, the days when I record something and it turns out well, and I like it. That's my favorite thing in the world, to be honest. That's my favorite feeling. And I sort of, all of my motivation is towards getting that feeling of having done music that I don't dislike.
Okay. And so that can occur on Sunday.
Well, yeah, well, cause I record on weekends for sure. I'm not.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I don't have a 9-to-5, so I'm sort of, my goal is to have a good day, and definitely recording a song that I like and that I continue to like for the rest of the day is my favorite moment in my life when that happens.
All right, cool. Okay, question 11. What advice should you have taken but did not?
Man, pretty much all the advice. It's interesting. I think about that because now I'm older and I have a nephew and niece and I'm always telling them this and that. Oh, you be careful of this. Don't be careful. You know, look out for that. And it's so hard when you're young and adults tell you something. And part of you knows that it's probably sound advice. But it's really hard to internalize and actually take the advice. And I wonder what that's about. I mean, I think we're, as human beings, until we touch the flame, it's hard to understand what hot is, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, everyone told me not to smoke cigarettes when I was young, and I did it anyway. And I think that, I wonder why I did it. I think I did it for a lot of stupid reasons, like, my dad always smoked and he was always a hero to me. So he always had a cigarette in every picture, you know?
Yeah.
And my memories of him were smoking. Same with my mom. They both smoked all day.
Yeah.
And so I think the stupid choice that I made was thinking that because they were cool, that the smoking must have been a part of that coolness. And it took me my whole life pretty much to realize that they would have been even cooler if they hadn't smoked, you know? That yeah. It would have been really cool if they'd been doing all the stuff they did and on top of it were smart enough to not smoke. That would have been great. Took me a long time to realize that. So, you know, that's the kind of advice I didn't take. You know, everyone told me that smoking was bad and I smoked anyway because I really identified with this idea of like, oh, well, this is what you do if you're a musician or whatever, an artist. And it's such a dumb idea. So, you know, I haven't smoked for a couple of years now, but still it's something I regret deeply.
All right. Well, at least you've come to terms with that. That's great. All right. We move on to question 12. What would make you kick someone out of your band and or bed and have you?
Yeah, I have. And or. Well, you know, I've been in this business for some time. I've experienced a lot of things and yeah, you know, I don't want to mention any names, but I have had someone in a band of mine who did a couple of bad things. You know, they were having some drug problems, which, you know, I can be sympathetic towards and tolerant of, but I kind of had to lay the law when it got too serious, and they it wound up affecting their work, and then they wound up stealing from me. From my bedroom, actually. So this actually doubles up as a bedroom story as well. So I kicked them out of my bedroom because they actually wound up stealing some stuff from my house, and that really hurt my feelings. And they stole it, you know, to sell it for whatever, to get high, and that really, it really hurt me, and I had to kick them out of the band. Or it wasn't a band, but it wasn't an official band, but I had to kick them off, you know, the team. And that hurt a lot. And you have to have boundaries, and the person that, you know, was someone that I loved, so it was hurtful. You know, there was another time a tour manager of mine didn't show up to the morning call to leave Amsterdam. We were on tour in Europe, and our tour manager didn't show up, and I was like, man, where is he? So I had to get the hotel manager to break into his bedroom because it was illegal. He was like, no, we can't break into the bedroom. And I was like, look, he has the float, which is all the finances for the tour. I was like, he has the float. We have to break into the room. So I get the tour manager, the hotel manager to break into the tour manager's room, and we opened the door, and it was just like chaos in there, but he wasn't in there. But there were like three TVs rolling with all sorts of nasty stuff on it because it was Amsterdam, and there was just powder everywhere and like clothes everywhere, and I was like, man, he's gone. I don't know where he is. So I rummaged through all of his belongings. I found the float, took the float. I wound up tour managing the rest of that tour. We get on the plane and I get a phone call from him, and I'm on the plane and I'm like, hey guys, it's him. I'm not going to mention any names in my band. My band looks at me. This is like 9 hours after he was supposed to be, you know, getting us to the airport. And I'm like, should I pick up? They're like, yeah. And I pick up the phone and he just goes, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. And hangs up. That was it. Never saw him again. Yeah, I think he, I think he got a little bit too excited to be in Amsterdam. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it sounds like it. That's a fascinating story. All right.
Well, so I had to fire him too. And believe it or not, he tried to get on the next tour with me. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, man. You know, that's too much. You can't do that and keep working with me. So, yeah, I do have limits.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like maybe something that you think of when you think of Amsterdam. The next question on the questionnaire is, what do you think of when you think of Canada?
Well, you know, Joni Mitchell and Neil Young, I guess, would be the first thing. I think about my friend Rufus Wainwright and his mom, Kate, and his sister, Martha, and that family. I remember touring up there with Rufus when I was young and getting to experience Montreal. It was so cool. And their scene was so cool, and they're all so talented. They used to sing Christmas carols and stuff as a family. I just remember being blown away by that experience. But yeah, I think about Neil Young, actually. You know, think about John Candy, I guess. I don't know. I think about comedy and music, I guess, and the cold, I guess, maybe. I don't know.
Did you ever meet John Candy?
No, but I was a big fan.
Yeah, he was unbelievable. Absolutely. Did you watch SCTV?
Yeah, exactly. That show, man, was so funny when I was a kid. There's something really funny. Like Canada has its own humor culture that's pretty incredible. Music and humor is the export that I like most.
Well, on behalf of the country, I appreciate your kind words and thank you. Thank you for saying so. All right, number 14. What was the first LP, 45, cassette, CD, or 8-track, or whatever it was, that you ever bought with your own money? The first thing. Do you remember?
Yeah, no, I remember this very well. You know, I used to get money for my teeth from the Tooth Fairy. I think it were like silver dollars or something, but they weren't silver. They were just like these coins that I would get, one for every tooth when I was young. And I saved those all up, and I went and bought a Human League LP.
Oh, yeah.
It was the one with that song Fascination on it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that was my favorite song ever at the time. And I also just remember the video for that that song. I forget what it was called. Like, oh, yeah, Don't You Want Me. I was working as a waiter in a cocktail bar. That one.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing the guy had like eyeliner and lipstick on, and he just looked like the coolest, sexiest dude I'd ever seen. And I just remember like the whole thing just confused me, because I was all titillated by the song and feeling all sorts of strange feelings and getting excited about it. And I think it just messed me up in a good way. It was an awakening of some sort. It was so, edgy, you know, for me at the time to see their brand of whatever sexiness was exciting for me. So yeah, that was my favorite album when I was really young, and went out and bought that with my Tooth Fairy money.
Nice. That's great. All right. I don't know if this one applies to you, this question, number 15. What was your most memorable day job? Have you ever had a day job, Sean?
I mean, not really. I mean, I never actually, I went straight from college to touring with Chivo Motto. So, I mean, that's not really a day job, is it?
Touring is hard. Touring is a lot of hard work. Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, it's not a 9-to-5.
No, I guess not.
Sure.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've been working as a musician my whole life. So no, I've never really had to work in an office or anything like that.
Okay. Let's bypass that one then and move on to the next one. How do you spoil yourself, Sean?
Honestly, the thing that I've been really worried about is I have a little bit of an addiction to synthesizers, to buying like vintage synthesizers on eBay.
Oh.
And I think sometimes I go a little far. And I feel like it's dangerous. Like at this point, you can just open up your laptop or cell phone and you can buy music gear. And, you know, the only thing I'm really obsessed with buying, like I never got into cars or anything. I don't really care about most stuff. It's music equipment that I have a weird kind of fetish for. So yeah, I got myself this keyboard that's called a Waldorf Quantum. Mm-hmm. And I bought that the other day. And when it arrived, I just felt kind of like I shouldn't have bought it. So I think I'm going to return it. No, I just felt like, what am I doing, man? I don't need this thing. And I thought I needed it, and I thought it was the coolest thing. And it is a great keyboard, but I just, you know, I have enough sense and I'm just going to return it because I feel like I'm just going nuts with that stuff. Like, I don't need a seventh synthesizer in that one little studio I have. It's like, it doesn't make sense. So yeah, I definitely am a little spoiled when it comes to synths and like guitar pedals. I'm just nuts about it. And I might have a little bit of a problem, like an addiction or something.
Well, you mentioned there were seven in the studio, but you also mentioned it's addiction. Do you know how many synthesizers you actually own?
I mean, I could count them out in my head right now, but it's too many.
Okay.
But I will, in my defense, I will say that I started collecting actually on that first tour that I went on with Chivo Amato. One of the first synths I bought actually was a Roland SH-1000 in Canada. I bought it in Montreal on one of my first tours. And it was cheap as dirt. So it wasn't like, I didn't start buying synths when they were super expensive and coveted. I started when no one wanted them. Like everyone was throwing away analog synths. So that was also when I got a White Arp Odyssey, which is kind of a collector's item because the white one has a special filter that Moog wound up suing them for, so then they came out as black. So I got my White Arp Odyssey in the 90s. They were still pretty affordable then, but since then I've had a sort of thing about buying, like a lot of guitar players, you know, like not like the cliche is like Nigel Tufnel has 1,000 guitars and Spinal Tap, and that's kind of the joke. I think I'm more like that with guitar pedals, effect pedals, and synths. It's sort of my addiction. So yeah, I'm a little spoiled when it comes to effect pedals and synths for sure. I think I've gone way too far. I'm like Jay Leno with cars or something.
All right. Well, I appreciate the candor there, and I hope you figure out a way to solve your issues and your.
I need to go to SA, Synthesizers Anonymous. I just need to stop.
Okay. Here's a. Speaking of stopping, perhaps, the next question is a fill in the blank. If I wasn't playing music, I would be?
Yeah, I would definitely be a visual artist or a movie director.
Okay.
In fact, I think I'm way better at drawing than I am at playing music, probably, which is weird because I should do that then. But I think it's just too lonely drawing. I like to play music because it's a social activity and you get to interact with your friends and make music with people, but drawing, you know, you just spend so much time sitting there all by yourself. And as much as I think I have talent for it, I can't. It's too lonely.
I see. Maybe you can do a collaborative thing of some kind. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. That's not my thing, though, with drawing. Like, I have done an animation once. I did an animation for a music video of mine.
Yeah.
For this album I did called Friendly Fire. And, you know, that was collaborative. It was fun. But I don't know. It wasn't. I don't have as much of a passion for it as I do for music, let's put it that way. But I do think I have a maybe better innate talent for it.
Probably. Okay. Well, I mean, given your parents' pedigree in terms of being visual artists, it makes sense to me that you would be good at it.
My mom is very good at drawing, so I think...
I thought your dad was a good drawer too, if I might say.
Oh, he certainly was, yeah. But my mom is really good, let's say.
Yes, your mom is on a whole other level, but I thought your dad was good too, is all I'm saying.
No, he's great at the cartoon kind of thing.
Yeah.
He was really good at that.
Those were very influential to me as a child, loving your father and, you know, loving your, being influenced by your dad and being immersed in everything that I could get my hands on and discovering his drawings, his illustrations. That meant a lot to me too.
Yeah, me too. I mean, in fact, I started to draw because of my dad, for sure.
Oh, I see.
He all of our magazines would be covered with little UFOs and guys running around. Like, he would draw on photos of National Geographic and stuff. And he liked to do collages and cartoons. And I started drawing because of that. In fact, he used to do drawing games with me. So we'd sort of like, he'd start a drawing and I'd finish it and vice versa. It was fun. But then I think I got more serious about it when I was older because of my mother.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're moving on to another question. We're almost done, by the way. Thank you, Sean, for engaging in the Exclaim questionnaire.
You're welcome. I just hope I get a number after this that tells me whether or not I'm crazy.
Yeah. I'll assign you a number at the conclusion for sure. Here's the next question. What do you fear most?
Besides death? I mean, what else is there to fear?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I mean, gosh, in this day and age, there's just such a long list of things we're supposed to be scared of, from meteor impacts to cometary impacts to ice age, pending ice age, you know, the Anthropocene, human-caused mass extinction, and
that's all death.
You know, nuclear war. I mean, yeah, I mean, all that stuff is terrifying.
Yeah.
I think right now the thing I'm scared most of is America moving towards some kind of irrevocable discord, some kind of like cultural civil war or something. That really scares me right now, yeah, to be honest. It feels like our country is being torn apart from within, and it's very sad. Yeah. And I hope that we find a way out of this darkness into a time when we are able to listen to each other again and have real conversations and not just yell at each other from across the canyon of the internet.
I agree with you. And speaking of hope, that segues nicely into our next question. Sean, what makes you want to take it off and get it on?
I've got a very low threshold, man. Just give me a box of Manischewitz and I'm down.
Okay, for future reference, that's good to know.
I'm naked right now. No,
all right, no. Please don't say that.
I'm wearing socks.
Okay, all right. Well, that paints a more
not on my feet though.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah, I know. You're getting hot, aren't you?
I don't know what to think.
Yeah, well, don't think. Just go with the flow.
All right. Here's the next question, because I think that's a sufficient answer. Everything you just said works for that answer, for that question.
Okay. Good.
The next question. What has been your strangest celebrity encounter? Perhaps you are the celebrity. Perhaps someone else is the celebrity.
Well, I don't consider myself a celebrity. I think people get confused about that. I am the child of two celebrities. It's very different.
Okay.
Because I know what celebrity is, and I ain't got that thing. But I do. Some people recognize me, but it's never because of me. It's because of my parents. So that's more like a secondary kind of celebrity. But I don't know. I've got to think about it because, you know, there's some that I probably can't even talk about if you're talking about crazy.
Strangest, I believe, is the phrase I used. What has been your strangest celebrity encounter?
Oh, man, I've got to really tread carefully here. Oh, man.
What, do you have a book deal or something? You're going to reveal all this in a tell-all memoir?
Oh, no, I can't. No, I can't. There's things I can never say, probably, you know? That's
really?
How it is.
Wow.
Well, you know, you want to be respectful, right?
So,
I guess one of the strangest things, to be honest, is what I actually wrote a song about it, Bubbles Burst, on the last Delirium album. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just one of many stories I have that are interesting from having a different kind of childhood, but it was you know, it's a song about being friends with Bubbles, Michael Jackson's chimpanzee.
Oh.
And spending time out at Michael's house in California with Bubbles and the boa constrictor and a bunch of other animals. And I think that was a super strange time, but not in a dark way. In an odd way, in a unique way. It was odd because, you know, Bubbles was all dressed up as in a kind of dandy outfits, and we were all running around playing video games and with this chimpanzee, and you know, it was a surreal scene. It was kind of part Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, part, you know, Dr. Doolittle.
Yeah.
And part, like, you know, Motown's greatest hits or something. It was a convergence of a lot of disparate universes that merged for a while. And that was a strange scene, but it was really fun. I mean, it was amazing to hang out with all those animals, but there was also something very eccentric about it, you know?
Well, yes, obviously. Was Michael cool with you?
He was the coolest dude I'd ever met, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, people, you know, they have a lot of opinions about him, and like anything else, my opinions can only be based on my experience. But he was super, he was super fun to hang out with. I mean, he was like a big kid, you know? So
yeah.
The time that I got to spend with him was, you know, just, it was like Disneyland all day long. You know, he'd set up water balloon fights and pie fights in basketball courts, you know, just really fun stuff where he'd like invite up all his friends over and there'd be two teams and everyone would dress in garbage bags and throw pies at each other. You know, it was like super high level fun.
Okay.
And it was orchestrated fun and insanity. And, you know, I mean, whatever happened with him and anyone else, I have no opinion of because I wasn't there, you know. But in terms of my experience, it was a really fun time, but it was a strange time. And there was something weird about the whole thing. I mean, you know, there's something odd about having, you know, giraffes in your house,
yes,
on your property, you know. And there's something, you know, there's just something strange about the whole thing. But, when I talked about it in Bubbles Burst, the song, I wasn't trying to be critical. I was simply trying to document the truth, you know, this happened, yeah, is all I was saying.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, well, I think a lot of people thought I was criticizing him or not criticizing him or whatever, but it wasn't about that. The song was really just documenting a strange time, like a surrealist moment of my life that was memorable. Let's,
yeah,
put it that way.
Yeah. Well, speaking of such things, in the same vein, who would be your ideal dinner guest, living or dead, and what would you serve them?
Honestly, if I could have a dinner with anybody, it would probably be Einstein.
Oh, why Albert? I mean, this seems like a weird thing to say, but why would you want to have dinner with Albert Einstein?
You know, I just think all of the deepest questions you've ever had, he'd be the kind of person you'd want to ask those questions to.
Hmm.
I heard that he had very plain taste in food, that, you know, he pretty much ate the same thing all the time, and it was pretty mild Austrian food, you know, just like sausages and potatoes or something. So I'd probably try to serve whatever he liked. But, you know, I'm a big science groupie. I try not to say I'm a science nerd, because that would imply that I actually understand science, and I'm not, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't the greatest student, but I'm a science groupie. I really love scientists, and I love thinking about those subjects, you know, relativity and special relativity and quantum mechanics and stuff. And I'd want to ask him about time, basically. You know, I'd want to ask him what he thought time was, really. I mean, I know he wrote a lot about that, but it'd be interesting to have a conversation with him about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I would love that. If I, you know, in an ideal world.
That's cool. That's a good
Maybe
answer.
Maybe Richard Feynman. But definitely, I think Einstein, above all other people, he just seems like such a monumental genius. Maybe Da Vinci, but Da Vinci, I don't speak Italian, so that might not have worked so well.
Right, right. Good call. Okay, well, that's a good answer. All right, we're almost done here. Here's another one. What does your mom wish you were doing instead?
Probably, you know, making her dinner or something, hanging out with her more. She definitely prefers when I'm around.
Okay.
So I always feel guilty if I don't spend enough time with her.
Okay. Well, finally, final question of the questionnaire. What song would you like to have played at your funeral, Sean?
Yeah, I've thought about that. You know, I mean, I think Chopin wrote his own Requiem. And Mozart did. I mean, in those days, I think it was normal to write I think Mozart didn't write a Requiem for himself, but it turned out being that.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't know if I would want to, you know, it depends. My mood changes about this answer, because it depends. Like, do I really want people to be super depressed at my funeral? Like, do I want to inflict them with crying while listening to, you know, Mozart's Requiem or something? Or do I want them just, like, make it easy for them and let them listen to, like, I don't know, an Andrew Dice Clay comedy album? You know, I'm not really sure. I kind of feel like my instinct would be to play something really beautiful and sad, but then that just feels kind of narcissistic. Like, I hope you're, like, super sad now. So the other part of me just kind of wants to not make a big deal about it. And I think the truth is, I don't really care what happens after I die so much. I'm a lot more focused on what happens while I'm alive. Let's put it that way.
All right. Fair answer. That's a fair answer. Sean, thank you for answering the Exclaim magazine questionnaire. I hope you learned something about yourself.
I hope you learned something about me.
No, I did. I did.
That's very intimate.
That's not the most important thing. It's that you learned something about yourself. And I want to ask you now a question about the Claypool Lennon Delirium and South of Reality. We don't have a lot of time left, but it's a great record. Is there something in particular you want to convey to the people who are about to listen to this album about maybe what kind of headspace they should get into in terms of what you're talking about, the two of you, you and Les?
Well, you know, I guess our album is sort of an epic prog psychedelic album for, you know, the modern person, because it's kind of rooted in King Crimson and Utopia and Yes, but it's the subject matter is very contemporary, and we're talking about how strange the world we live in is and how differently strange from the past. And so I think it's a good record for today to sit and reflect upon the strange surrealism of the modern world.
Is it strange and surreal for you to be working with Les Claypool?
It is. I mean, it is. It was at first, because I was such a big fan of Primus when I was a kid. So,
yeah,
you know, that was kind of it was kind of a dream to get to play with him. But now we're such old friends that I've become comfortable with it. And it's even more fun now, because I'm relaxed and I feel like I can do a good job without overthinking and worrying about the fact that I'm playing with a legend.
Nice. Well, it's a cool record. As I say, we are out of time. I thank you for all the time. You gave me a lot of time, Sean, and I really, really do appreciate it. It's nice to speak with you again. If there was one song from South of Reality that I could play for people right now that you can select for us, what song would you pick?
The one that I'm feeling the most right now is this one, Blood and Rockets, that is about Jack Parsons, the man who started Jet Propulsion Laboratory and that turned into NASA. It's about him and his very interesting history. He was not only a rocket scientist, but he was also a member of Aleister Crowley's cult, and he wound up blowing himself up in an alchemical experiment. So the whole story is really out there. I got it from this book called Sex and Rockets, and it's an interesting story, and I think it's a fun ride.
All right, this is Blood and Rockets by the Claypool Lennon Delirium. Sean, thank you so much again for your time, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you.
Special thanks to Sean Ono Lennon for appearing on this, the 468th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and available on all iOS and Android platforms and also on things like Spotify, YouTube, and Audioboom as well. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you wish to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com, vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Vish Creative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. You can also listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time around the world at CFRU.ca or on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. Thank you very much to all of you who do this. It means a lot, and it would really help sustain the show. So again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks also to my pal Jim Guthrie for letting me use the instrumental version of his song The Rest Is Yet to Come to end this show each week. Visit jimguthrie.org for more info about him. And finally, you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode and other episodes and for subscribing to this podcast and maybe telling your friends to check it out. It's all very, very helpful. I will leave you for now, but I will be back soon, hopefully. And I hope you're well. And I will, yeah, I'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.